What's your agenda? I mean, Yanni sort of told me a little bit last night.
But the reason why Kiri's asking about the agenda is because...
Because I always ask about the agenda.
Well, he's... yeah, he's an organizer. But also because he is going to help to whatever extent he can from South Carolina and wants to, you know, understand what we're going to be trying to do and develop some relationship so that he can stay in the loop. And he's also helping me with my papers and things like that. So maybe you can each just identify yourself briefly so he'll know where you're all coming from.
Well, I'm Susan McKee, and I've been in this community now 3 years, going on our fourth year from Atlanta. My husband and I moved up here from Atlanta with 8 children. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we got here, just, you know, very quickly, we walked into this, what we thought was a very progressive, very liberal, you know, affluent community.
So
there you go.
The last one works.
And we're really put back by what we found in terms of what was going on with the black community.
Uh-huh.
Couldn't understand why the African American students in the schools were performing several points below, you know, just the average student. Couldn't understand why we weren't seeing African American and Latino kids in the music programs and band programs. And, you know, we started getting involved from that perspective. Jumped into the NAACP,
okay.
Kind of moved us forward. We understand now that there's this whole history piece that's been going on for many, many years. And then we go, oh, light bulb goes off. No wonder the kids are disengaged. No wonder this is the black community's perspective on education. And you know, we come from that place where, wow, this isn't acceptable. We live in a district that has the money, that has the resources.
Right.
Why are our children still failing?
Her son came home and said, Mom, people here think black kids are stupid.
My children never. I mean, I would have never heard that from their mouth. You know,
and he knew it wasn't true. But
Right.
But
and he was able to pick up on that.
Oh, yeah.
From
this is
the whole system.
This is my 15-year-old son that you just met. And, you know, he's a kid who, you know, we've really emphasized the value of a good education. And that's one of the reasons why we moved here from Atlanta. So, you know, our kids were gifted in Atlanta. We get here and we're told that, well, it's a process you got to go through. Mm-hmm. You know, okay, we've been very patient.
Uh-huh.
We're in our fourth year now. None of our children were ever moved into that category identified. And not that that's the issue, but we were thinking, if we're having to fight so hard for our children who have worked so hard to be above board,
sure.
and where our expectation is of them, what the heck's going on with the rest of the kids?
That's right.
That maybe's right here.
Yep.
You know, so we've looked into the budget, the allocations, the accountability, and, you know, we're starting to put some things together. And like I said, we come and we meet people like Nancy, and we've met Miriam and Yanni, and they're filling us in on the stuff that's gone on in this community for many, many years. And, you know, again, we're at that point where, you know, we know it's going to take a lot of work, but the children, the black children of this community are not in touch with at all any significant pieces of history that even their great uncles were involved
right,
in.
Right.
Who was James Britton? James Britton was the uncle of the little boy that I'm working with right now that the school is saying, you know, he's failing. Does this kid even know? So the local history, I think, for many of our children in this community can make some difference, can start playing a role in terms of these children come from an amazing history and amazing place, and they don't know it.
Right.
Because everything that they're told is, well, you didn't pass this EOG, and you didn't mark this on this score, and so
sure.
You're not gifted, and it's this constant.
Yeah. Should have
reinforced by the kind of the geographic isolation of the various black communities in the area too. Mm-hmm.
So right, so here
that's
we are 4 years later.
An important role of segregation that enabled that.
You know, Yanni would say things like institutional racism. you know, we didn't think about that before until we got here. And again, mm-hmm. we're like, wait a minute. They had this highly gifted program called LEAP mm-hmm. at one of the middle schools. I don't even know if they've ever had a black child in their program.
It's
or a Latino kid.
I think it's
an old. It is an isolated, highly gifted program within the school building.
And how do they measure gifted? What's
test,
the criteria?
Test.
So my children are on the out, you know, they're in the school and they're looking and they're saying, well, I guess they're, and this is my kids being, you know, kids, well, I guess they think there's not one black kid in this district that's smart enough to be in that group, huh, Mom?
The way they've set it up, that's how it is.
Right.
They set it up such that that is what they've got going. It's crafted. I deeply believe that many people in that program, parents, want it that way. Because
they see it as
that we have to...
Yeah, there's a market
it's
for it that's driving it.
You don't have to have these classes based just on tests. You can set up other criteria. This just, I mean, we should
and
discuss
that's called
this
lowering the standards.
No, I understand what the challenge is going to be.
It's very...
Sure.
Can we keep on with the introductions?
Sorry. I'm Nancy McDermott. I was born and raised in North Carolina. I grew up in High Point, went to UNC. Was in the Peace Corps in Thailand years ago and was in Southern California for most of my family life. We moved back here 10 years ago with my husband's job from San Diego when our daughters were 4 and 8. Mm. And so they finished growing up here in the schools. The younger one is now 14 and is a freshman at East with some of the stupendous kids. And our older daughter just started at Brown. I just finished at East Chapel Hill High School, and she made me an activist by getting fired up about the Rogers Road community, which is the 150-year-old African American community, just what used to be just outside of town where they put the landfill 37 years ago, saying we'll close it 10 years and then 10 more years, and now at 37 years they have to close it, and so they said, we will put a waste transfer station right here, and the community said no.
So she got involved?
She got involved and started riding her bike and saying, we have to do this, and I went one time just to make her be quiet, and then next thing you know, there was Yanni,
and I knew Yanni from Mizzolo.
I was in the Yanni fan club because of, while reading and doing nothing but reading, the fight that he led against the Bell, was that the award?
Yeah, we were just talking about it.
White supremacists, and it's like, in those days nobody knew any better, and somebody wrote a letter and said, no, that's wrong, her own brother was against it, and she wasn't just going along with the times, she was a white supremacist, she wrote things, she worked, you know, and so that I knew your name, also then I joined the NAACP, and so I saw Yanni at meetings, but I didn't get to know Yanni until meeting at Faith Tabernacle Church, working on Rogers Road, and I'm very, I took a class called The South in Black and White, taught by Dr. Tim Tyson and Mrs. Mary Williams at Haytai Heritage Center a couple of years. I took it probably maybe 2 years ago, maybe three.
Yeah.
And it backed up so many things that I've, you know, hunches and thoughts, and it filled in the, you know, connected the dots, and I got so much from that, realizing how much information is out there, how much is known, how powerfully clear all this becomes when people know, and that everybody most people are operating on ignorance. It's by choice. I'm not saying if they, you know, they don't want to know all that, but it's literally not out there. It's literally, I bet you would have to go through 100 white people before you find somebody who knew who Emmett Till was. I didn't know till I took the class, but everybody knows who, you know, you can name 5 Confederate generals, and there's a shrine, and, you know, all that. And the local stories, and just that our sense of the civil rights movement is something that black people did so they could eat in restaurants.
Right.
And the passiveness that we're getting away with the idea that there was just this situation, this unfortunate, maybe not so unfortunate situation that people brought on themselves, and you know the brainwashing that goes so far back. And Tim Tyson pointed this out, that black people are ignorant and helpless and, you know, just, they're lucky that they got saved from that, you know, and black people were slaveholders, you know, all that stuff, and just darkies. And then after the Civil War, when they got freedom, they're menacing, marauding, evil men who want your women. That, so there's a movie that shows, it's like, this is what they were putting out, and then they put out that. Why? And that the two iconic movies of America are Birth of a Nation and Gone with the Wind.
Yeah.
And then when The Great Debaters comes out, most white people don't go to see it, even though Denzel Washington's in it, and even though it's fabulous, the Carolina Chocolate Drop sing. And there's, oh, well, it wasn't really true, they did, like Gone with the Wind is true. Like any, you know, the double standard that comes up whenever you want to do something of the new. And then being involved in renaming Martin Luther King Boulevard, that was a big eye-opener. The way. And then now with fighting the waste transfer station, it's been such a lesson in institutional racism, how we can't get through to the good people who on some level would not accept this if they were forced to see it, because nobody says, we're going to put it there because they're black. Or because we're racists. I mean, that whenever racism is brought up, it is only brought up and allowed to be discussed if it's Sonia Sotomayor or,
when
we said institutional racism, environmental racism, people said, you're calling the county commissioners racist, two of whom are African American.
Yeah.
So these puffy letters about Valerie Boucher is not a racist, how dare you? And it never gets fixed. It's like, and then,
yeah,
all.
Yeah.
So to me, the knowledge, the information, the connecting the dots, getting kids excited about it, getting kids to go interview people, and making white people admit that they sat in church next to people who had hurt people on Saturday night, that there's no conflict between belonging to the Ku Klux Klan and that people knew it was wrong. You know, you just can't tell me.
Because we know Jim and his family; they're not all that bad. You know, they're good family
people. The double standard.
You know, I don't agree with some of his views, but
you know,
they're more or less like us. Yeah, they are.
That's right. And that no white person is responsible for anything not done by him or her personally. That every black person is responsible for everything that any black person ever did, or is thought to have done, or might have done, or history says they did. So a black man walking down the street is carrying it all.
Unearned Nobel Prize.
Oh, so earned. That's why I called you back, because I opened up and I saw, you know, I'm not even going to dignify that. It's the Nobel Prize, and it's putting hope out there. Oh, my God. Yeah.
I heard it at 7.
Oh, I turned on my computer. I'm so sorry.
I thought it would encourage him to withdraw from Afghanistan. It would be a great thing.
I don't think that's the strategy.
I hope so. Well, some historian described it as an award of encouragement. It isn't so much of a history, but one of encouragement and hope.
Well, it's the message that he's put out there. I mean, he put that out there and got elected.
That's
so
right.
To me, that's not
that's
like
true.
How many months. I mean, how many months does it take anybody to do anything?
Right.
He said, yes, I will talk to Iran. We will send somebody and sit in the room and talk to them.
Right.
And he was excoriated for that. That was gutsy. That's peace.
So, Marion?
He's under attack. I'm Marion Thompson. I'm from New York. I came here to join my children and grandchildren. I have a history of labor and community organizing and teaching, long in the New York City school system. Long in the New York City school system. And it's the same practice, same problem.
When did you come to Chapel Hill?
I came here in 2007, so I'm going to be entering my third year next year. I'll just concur with everything. I think we bury and distort history. I mean, the kids are not getting it, and I think that's why I thought Yanni's whole project was really so important to bring to the children, and through the children, their parents, because I think there actually are a lot of parents that would be open to history. First of all, we have a very unusual community. We have a long-standing racist community, but we also have an emigrant community. Many of us, there are very few people, except for Nancy, that I'm meeting, that live here. They're coming from other places.
University.
That doesn't mean that there aren't other racist struggles, but they're coming from other places, and it makes it a very kind of an intriguing cosmopolitan place. So I think we have a lot of opportunity, and I'm not sure anyone, after listening to this, two of you, except maybe in Rogers Road, frankly. I think Rogers Road is, for me, the most visceral challenge to racism and some of the continuing grievances over police abuse.
Oh, my God.
So also in the NAACP, also in Women's International, and I've probably joined every peace and justice group that exists in this, in Orange County. So that's why I'm invested in this history project, primarily because, first, as Yanni and I were discussing yesterday, because it gives a real push to strengthening NAACP. And through NAACP, creating a collective force from a 100-year civil rights voice to inform the continuing struggles against racism and injustice in this community. I was jumping immediately to the schools because I would just want to get a real beginning of a curriculum, forcing the school board to take it seriously, forcing the superintendent to really give more than rhetoric. But I think the first step in really making NAACP as conscious, which they're not many, in NAA you have the elders who live here forever and know the history, but then you have the 90% of the others that won't quote the statistic that are good at heart but don't know the history except as they learn it and pick it up themselves. So how we could make it a really institutional obligation and then proselytizing into the schools in particular, I think would be very challenging.
So, you all know me, and come in.
Tennis.
I guess we have someone hiding.
Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
Good. Oh, hello.
Male here.
Hi, I'm
your
male.
Oh, thank you.
Okay.
Do I need to sign anything? Okay, thanks.
I also a tiny little bottle in a very big one.
So, I'm coming at this from a good deal longer in the community than all of you. And, so that just sort of has built up my commitment. And so it's a developmental kind of thing. And y'all, I think, are just as committed as I am, and just not as experienced in this particular community. And also, the area where we're doing organizing, sort of Terry helped me understand, is a new, relatively new in a lot of ways, framework of struggle that goes beyond some of the traditional things that people were involved in for welfare rights and police brutality and labor organizing. I mean, culture has always been part of it, but I have really gravitated towards that. A lot of it's intuitive, probably because I saw these incredible struggles by housekeepers, for instance, knocking their heads up against a wall. But it was an invisible wall. Yeah, it was power, it was institutional power, but it was a lot more than, the administration. And it was a kind of a context that people operated in where black people were easily dismissed, where there's double standard was imposed all the time, where people didn't want to look at how the history affected injustice because this was directly against the interests of the university. And so there was, what was this thing we were pushing against? And as the years went by, probably somewhere in the 80s, as I was developing my, dissertation in the 90s, I guess, I started doing a lot of research and looking at this issue of institutional racism. And at first it was just a few people writing things about it. Sociologists didn't seem to me to have a whole lot of connection to anything. But increasingly you had anti-white privilege movements. You had that guy you were asking me about, that guy who's a writer who does workshops.
Anti-racist?
Tim Wise. So, you know, and I had some interactions with him, and I had interactions with this guy, Lowenstein, who is a historian, but he wrote books about institutional racism, you know, the lies your teacher taught you.
Jim Lowen.
What did I say? Lowenstein?
Lowenstein.
There is a Lowenstein.
Different movement figure.
Yes.
Yeah. And also during the mid-90s, the Housekeepers developed a lawsuit. And their lawsuit was basically a history-based class action lawsuit, where they didn't just say, these workers are systematically discriminated against. They don't get the wages other people get, they don't get the respect other people get, blah, blah, blah. That was all part of it. But they also said, this is systematic. It's historical. It has happened throughout the history of the university. It's not something that happens to be going on just today. And these are its roots. Slavery, white crow, Jim Crow. And of course this was exactly what I was doing my research on, in terms of the civil rights movement. Where did the civil rights movement come from? Because there was all kinds of white people and commentators who said, well, this shouldn't be happening in Chapel Hill because this is the most liberal place in the South. And we've got all these great people like Frank Porter Graham. So, little by little, things all came together, and with the Housekeepers' struggle, I turned out that Al wanted to present a very historical case about the history of the university's labor practices, and charge reparations. It was sort of a broader focus for reparations than the traditional focus of slavery. You know, it wasn't just because some business made money from slavery or that the university owned slaves or this, that, or the other. It was the whole way that social groups were influenced, power relations, economic relations, all kinds of the whole kit and caboodle were produced and reproduced, manufactured to a certain standard where there was a low wage, demeaned, racially defined laboring class.
Visible on site.
Yes. Visible today, forever. And this was a consciously organized body of workers, and it was organized by the slave owners to begin with. and they had a whole series of cultural webs that they would catch black people up in, and practices, laws, all kinds of stuff that kept people in place as slaves, and it also prevented white poor people from joining with them in their similar class interests. You know, because white people in North Carolina, most of them actually weren't very well off. And so this was sort of the most powerful dynamic of slavery, other than the actual fact of slave production. And this got actually modified as emancipation came about. It got modified. They tried to impose the Jim Crow laws. You know, they tried to, not Jim Crow, they tried to impose the black codes, sort of go back to slavery. Black people organized resistance, tried to organize the Republican Party in the South. And so there was this huge struggle all throughout the 19th century, where race relations were not set in stone. And you find many situations with black and white people cooperating and struggling over cooperation, dealing with the race issue.
Mm-hmm. It's a very important story. I was looking on the attempt to destroy interracial organizing. Mm-hmm. That's one of the glorious, that's one of the really, I think, important is, you know, sometimes you need history to help inspire, mm-hmm. not just despair. This is a very inspiring story, and the history, that's why I was anxious to get to know
and it's been,
labor historians to join us who really
who,
have that
Who
passion.
Said that it had been engulfed or eaten or buried or suppressed or something?
Yeah.
Somebody said that.
Yeah.
Just now. And that story has been completely suppressed.
Right.
And it's clear to me why, which is that the powers that be do not want people to know their history of resistance, to understand that it's possible and important to transform things by coming together across race lines, just as it is with gender and other things. I mean, it doesn't take duh to figure that out. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, people are blinded by these cultural mechanisms that have been embedded in the whole culture and in people's minds, and even in black people's minds. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I started understanding these things, and I did research on Reconstruction and what was going on at the university during that period of time. And I wrote a paper on Cornelius Phillips Stinson, who was a real big famous icon of the university during the whole period from the 1860s up through the 1890s or so. And I found out that there was a Bell Award. And I found out that this award was, I mean, we had had struggles already by that point in time. This was in the about 2000 or so, somewhere in there. But we'd already had these struggles, like, you know, about the idea that Silent Sam was offensive because it represented slavery and white supremacy. But there was never any great investigation into why did we have Silent Sam, or why was there so much of this? You know, we were frankly just inundated and surrounded by a commemorative landscape that embodied the celebration of white supremacy. and certainly not of African Americans, let alone most anything else that was half white progressive. So, unlike many other things, like for instance the names of buildings, mm-hmm. most of the, say the main building people objected to was Saunders Hall. And Saunders Hall, however, just like Silent Sam, was erected during a peak era of white supremacy around, Silent Sam was 1913, I think, and Saunders Hall was 1924, I believe it was named. And there was a whole ton of buildings named after white supremacists in the 70s. I mean, they were named in the 1920s.
Are you recording this?
I hope so. Yes. That was Nate, but he'll call me. And so this, unlike them, the Bell Award was created for the university's bicentennial in 1993. And the Bell Award was an award that was specifically aimed at celebrating diversity in women.
A great campaign.
And I thought, this is just too much, you know.
One thing we never, you just wonder, what were the deliberations in that room that, you know, that came up with that idea? And I think we figured out who made the decision and who was in the room, but we never really, it would be, that's something that we should have done is demanded those documents through a Freedom of Information.
Well.
To figure out who, you know, what was the
family.
Back and forth? I mean,
didn't she have, isn't her family very active in promoting?
Oh, absolutely, yeah, but they may not have, I'm not sure what role they played. Because over the years, Cornelia took on a life of her own for the university, and the family, I don't think, even needed to do that much promotion. She became such an icon that she, you know, everybody, not everybody, but the university really owned her as, you know, our, I don't know, what, founding mother or our...
This arch segregation.
Pardon?
This arch segregation.
No, they wouldn't say that.
No, of course not.
They would
not
say that, but you know, she's recognized as the leading woman in the university's history.
Because?
Because of the role she played over the years.
In building the union.
Allegedly. Supposedly reopened, spearheading the campaign to reopen the university after the dark days of Reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
Which in those days, in the 1950s, let's say, Reconstruction was demeaned and dismissed as the most contemptible, corruptible period of North Carolina history.
I think it, to this day, I mean, I don't think that's changed a lot. I mean, maybe
no,
not,
it hasn't.
But it's...
I mean, we've chipped into it a little bit.
It's chipped. Yeah, like my daughter.
But a sad, hard time when people didn't have enough to eat, mm-hmm. and these people came down from up north, and it was just a terrible time.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it was a terrible, bad time.
Right.
My daughter, however, took an orientation. That's really interesting how, you know, in a way it's part of the celebration of organizing that we need to put into this history, like the interracial labor organizing, like what's happened at the university, chipping away at various wars. I think that part of history is important, too, because it's... just as an organizer, it's more inspirational. My daughter comes into UNC, and that's three, 4 years ago, and they had an orientation, again, around diversity and so on, and Tim Tyson was one of the more prominent figures. Tim Tyson was in the orientation. So you see, you know, we need to also document those things. But Yana, you can cut me off, but I want to move the discussion in part of how what we discussed yesterday, which is why it was important to pull you two into the conversation, which is how we move this, your history, your legacy, your research, the race facts on the ground, and how we move this into an organizational form and who can help us do it. And you already have Truth to Power Project as part of the history committee. And I just want to, and some of the research, we need some technical assistance because there's invaluable files on Yanni's computer, just to put a little bit of administrative, I don't know, nor, and someone has to retrieve it and back it up. So there are both technical issues here and some organizational issues, well, they're all part of organizational issues, as to how we move this project forward, how do we move it, as we were talking about yesterday, first through the NLA, and then I'm really serious about working this through the schools.
So I actually would like to stay on this bench.
Okay.
Okay.
I don't want to leave here without that.
Well,
I think we'll get there. I mean, this is the
okay.
Carrie might think I probably am going into this too much, I'm not sure. But to me it's important to understand how this stuff developed.
Yeah.
And you tend, I think, to want to get places very quickly and leapfrog.
No, I want to make sure it's being recorded and that the urgency that we were talking about yesterday gets moved today. So I just want to put that on the agenda.
Well, okay. I mean, I think
so you keep going as long as we then move this to an organizational form.
Well, think about, I mean, what's everyone's time frame today, and how do we allocate time?
I mean, I know you don't have as much time as other folks, but how much time do you have?
Well, let's see what other people have.
Today,
it's now 12:15.
I got here much later than I planned. I could stay another hour for now. Mm-hmm. I plan to come back.
So plan on another hour. Mm-hmm.
I think, I mean, hearing you go through this to me is really, it's going to help me understand how to move forward, because it's like there's so many things to do. So I actually think this is on track.
Yeah, well, let's keep pushing this way, and I think it'll work out.
Well, let's. Maybe we could make sure we save like 20 minutes at the end to talk about follow-up.
Yeah, that's fine.
The basic thing that I'm thinking that we want to accomplish today is develop a sort of a more concrete and visionary understanding of what our committee is and would do, mm-hmm. and lay out a sort of a beginning agenda for both some small things like who else do we need to recruit and who's going to talk to them and how we're going to get documents to people, but also a little bit more strategic, like okay, next week we'll start talking about slavery or whatever we decide.
Touch on about what? Yeah.
Slavery.
You know, we'll decide what we're going to have. We'll start doing some study discussion next
mm-hmm.
week.
Oh, that would be.
Because we need to move rapidly along, from my point of view.
Mm-hmm.
I'm passionate about that.
Yeah.
So, out of this came the first picket of the Bell Award, which was carried out, I think we had the uh, Coalition for Economic Justice or workers, something. We had some kind of little framework where we were doing things, and I think that this idea sort of came up out of my head, but basically, and I think that might have been the year that we had the Freedom Legacy Project. Actually, we had a campus organization that I, you know, pulled together, and we actually called the Freedom Legacy Project. And the whole idea was to challenge institutional racism, and we had a Challenging Institutional Racism Week, and we worked with the BSN. So, you know, I actually did quite a bit of stuff. And this was also a fairly energized point for the BSM to jump on institutional racism.
Do they have archives? Do they have records? Yes, no?
It's hard to know. They have some stuff.
I'm sure there's some things over at the you know, the Southern Historical Collection, but whether that's done systematically, I'm sure it's not done systematically, but there are BSM collections.
Yeah, if you look at their website, you might think you could find something that was 2 years old.
But that revival of that history would be very significant in bringing in some of the people you suggested we draw into this conversation.
Sure.
So I do, but it doesn't sound like that.
Yes.
Let me tell you, there's
a
message.
Does that say something on the front?
Probably me leaving a message.
Oh, yeah, it's Nate leaving a message.
Yeah.
So we just... Did you open it up all the way?
I did. It just said one missed call, unknown, or something.
I think it won't be anymore. So what happened was we got this little picket together. And we weren't able to have too many people. But basically, I presented a proposal for Wilf and said, here's the situation, and we want to make an issue of this award, and they're having their award, and the person we know who's getting the award is Jane Brown, who is someone everybody knew, and most of the people who've gotten this award have been, I'd say at least half of them have been quite progressive people. It's not a good old world's award completely, although it is to some extent. And so I'd like to organize an exposure of this thing and a picket and so forth. And so what we did was we came up with a leaflet, and I also talked with some other people. There was a white student who had contacted me about the paper I'd written and wanted to do something. There was my daughter Sandy was very involved in the student movement at that point in time, and here was Smiley and some of them. And there was a black graduate student who became involved. I can't remember. Oh, I know. The other group was Feminist Students United. Feminist Students United.
They still exist, don't they?
Yes, they do. And they have been one of the key groups on a low-level scale in this whole struggle. Partially because they have a certain kind of standing, and it's not very easy for people to say, you're being a sexist for attacking Cornelius Spencer if you've got Wilf and Feminist Students United in your corner.
Although some people found it all too easy to attack us on that.
Some people did. Woe to them.
Because that was exactly one of the lines of defense on their part.
Right.
Yeah.
And including people who were very prominent, like Anthea Scott, who's a very prominent white anti-racist historian, as is, what's your name, herself? Spencer Love.
Spencer, yeah.
And Spencer Love, who is the descendant of Cornelia, worked at the Oral History Project with Jacqueline.
And she was these women were with you or against you?
Against.
Against. Oh,
against?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, Ann Scott. Against because it's women? Or
yeah, well, that was part of it. You know, Ann Scott, I think, you know, part of the argument was I've devoted my whole life to, you know, elevating, you know, to writing women back into history. Why is it of all the people that you target, why are you, you know, it's suspicious that you're targeting a woman as a, you know, as a racist and...
There are all these Klansmen on the buildings.
And, yeah, and you yeah. got Josie.
Well, that was part of
Josephus
it.
Josephus Daniels, and they always said, well, you know, there's a lot of men who are really much worse racists. Mm-hmm. Now, part of that was simply that they didn't understand the history. They did not really understand her role during the white supremacy movement. It was more like she just happened to get caught because she wrote so much. Mm. Hey, Jean.
Hey, Jean. Grab a chair.
And Spency felt personally attacked.
Spency was my personal friend.
Who Yanni knew from back from college, right?
Yeah.
But she, Spency's, you know, I think part of Spency's argument was that, you know, despite her shortcomings, I mean, she was nevertheless this very powerful, important figure. And
she had done
she is worth
more to help than to her.
Yeah, and she is worth venerating and honoring.
Now, did you answer the question of all those, aside that they were stones and died and she came into the current period, but how did you answer the gender question when so many think much more despicable racists were sitting there on buildings and continue?
I have the answer. This was done in 1994.
Well, that's what
that
I was saying.
Part
this
of
was,
it.
It was the later.
There's yep. a recent one for Josephus Daniels.
Yeah, the reason why there weren't very many celebrated female white supremacists because they weren't very prominent. And they weren't very prominent, and secondly, they were not empowered at the present university to have buildings named for them or anything like that.
But I did ask Yanni because, you know, you're opening, you're really taking actions that open consciousness, the dramatic actions that open consciousness, that are media visible. And I think tearing down the names of those buildings. It's wonderful that you did the Bell Awards. It did exactly what you wanted it to do. I was just curious about
part
the
of
gender
it,
stuff, because I do think the building names will come down. I think it's...
Part of it, too, we also, I think, we argued that
attention.
This was just part of it, you know, that we didn't want to stop at the Bell Award, that we felt like this needed to be... What we wanted was a seat at the table, so that whenever the university made some decision about naming a new building, whenever these kinds of issues came up, we wanted some democratic representation.
Yes. So you were really transforming the university.
Exactly. It's not
step,
about,
chip
I mean,
by
it's,
chip.
It's only in a small way about
we wanted
Cornelia Spencer.
An institutional solution,
yeah.
A systemic solution as opposed to a single issue solution, which is what the university and everybody always wants.
Yeah, they try to
isolate it and limit
it. It did force some transparency on that issue, too, because the next year they created, or they at least rearticulated the rules around naming issues. Is it the Buildings Committee or something? They have a naming committee on campus, and they were forced to be public about how they go about doing that. It wasn't quite, you know, what we would have wanted to see, but at least they were pressed to be a bit more explicit about how things get done.
But it also speaks to the importance of the project and historic context.
Mm-hmm. Of
so
the what?
Bell is historic context. Bell is in context. Rogers Road is in context. Continued achievement, disparity, and inequity is in context. So that's where this project, I think, takes on.
Well, to speed it along a little bit, this picket was successful beyond my dreams.
Cool.
The Wilk women played their part valiantly and went and, you know, flyered people on that day. the leaflet was appropriately drastic and provocative. Why does UNC honor a white supremacist to celebrate women?
Straight and to the point.
Yeah. And it gave quotes from her that were just outrageous.
That's so important. Because people are thinking, well, so she had servants. That's really good.
Yeah.
That's really good.
And so then it was successful from a media point of view. And the way that worked was that the Daily Tar Heel was there and picked up a story that they put on. It was a prominent story. I can't remember if it was front page or not. But they picked up the story with some of the folks involved in the picketing it, you know, in front, and some quotes from me and some quotes from what's her name, Brown. And, you know, all of that. And if that had just stayed within the bounds of the university, I don't think very much would have happened. But because Cornelia Phillips Spencer is so much an icon of the state as well as the university, or the, anything that's an icon of the university is an icon of the state.
Right.
What happened was that there was a tremendous sense of outrage on the part of journalists who are basically, most of them sort of liberal or moderate journalists at least, D.G. Martin, you know, a variety of other people. And they wrote, in response to this article, they wrote big, long stories, big, long columns in the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh paper and so on and so forth, that just hacked away at, here's a graduate student doing the same old thing. Every spring they've got to find something to protest. You know, what's the big deal? Look at all these other buildings. You know, we're not going to look. The whole theme of the university was, for its bicentennial, was look forward, not backward, right? Which I knew was a cover-up to begin with. And Joe Herzenberg had actually talked with me about being involved on the committee because he was concerned that they wouldn't tell the story honestly. He was a big supporter of Sam
Phillips?
Yeah, Sam Phillips. And thought he should be really celebrated because he was a white anti-racist in the 19th century who turned against the Democratic Party and white supremacy and was a lawyer and prosecuted the Klan and eventually ran for Solicitor General, State Attorney General for the Republicans in North Carolina, which was a killer. You know, it's like running for President of El Salvador during the war, something like that. And he did have to leave the state eventually, but he became a U.S. Solicitor General for 12 years.
I remember reading a letter to the editor or column or something saying, contrary to the idea that she was just, that's what people said, her own brother was disappointed.
One of us wrote that.
And this was
the letter I was
for you anyway, but I thought that really,
yeah.
That, I mean, that's so meaty. Just sort of like people saying, everybody thought that, nobody knew, da da da. Really,
we did, we had a kind of, you know, like Clinton had a war room. We were able to really, I think, nail them. Every time they came up with one of these covers, we had the evidence to just come back at them and explain very clearly with historical evidence, you know, this is why that's wrong, you know.
Actually.
Yeah.
And there's this old professor named William Powell who wrote the big illustrated version of the history of the university. And he, the Daily Tar Heels stoked the fires too, because they came out with an editorial on the whole Bell Award protest without actually even consulting any of us. And so they consulted Powell, who's the North Carolina history professional, and they consulted the police. This was a different event, but what I'm talking about is when students decorated Saunders Hall with anti-Klan stuff, about the same time, a little bit before that. But the argument was, hey, this is nothing new. All the building, everybody was a racist back then.
Yeah, what excuse.
You know, and this is a totally racist view. You know, it totally takes black people out of the picture as being part of everybody.
Everybody felt that way.
Everybody was racist.
Yeah. And at the same time, it's like he's the big authority on history, and he either doesn't know about or doesn't write about Sam Phillips. Mm. You know, it's just atrocious. So it wasn't accurate history either. And then the Daily Tar Heel went way over the edge because they said, we understand that people today might be morally outraged by taking care of the building, blah, blah, blah. And while we sympathize with the black students, we can't really condemn the building or the university because that was just how it was back then.
And put a plaque up outside the building telling the real story, you know?
The plaque was put up in 1985.
That tells the real story of who these people were and what they
were? No, it tells the originally tells the story, you know, this is who Saunders was. And they don't include the KKK, and they don't include the Secretary of the Board of Trustees and stuff like that.
And the
plans. So, there's just so many contradictions. And this was one of the things you really have to debunk, is the idea that everybody back then was a racist.
Mm-hmm.
So we did, to some extent. And basically, then what happened was it percolated for a year because the chancellor and nobody else got in touch with me, you know, to say, well, what should we do about this? Or I propose this or that.
He did get in touch with you?
No.
No contact. And I can't remember, I was either busy or sick or whatever it was. I didn't have the energy to deal with it that year. Those kinds of things take a lot of energy. But I just got so irritated with the whole idea that we were going to let this slide. That the next year I said, well, we've got to do something about this. But it can't be what we did the last time because that's not going to take us any further. And so I thought, what we need to do is assemble enough moral authority in the sense of prominent people who represent different parts of the community who would say this needs to be done away with, we need to do something better here, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so I wrote this draft letter. And I gave it to a variety of people to see who would sign it. And we got, I think, 22 or 23 names that included people who would be very hard for the administration or other right-wing groups to just dismiss. So, like the Sandy Darity of the Institute for African-American Research. His father was the first black PhD to graduate from UNC. what's her name? Head of Women's History.
Head of Women's History?
Yeah, she was the director of Women's Studies.
Where are these names?
Yeah, all of them.
Where?
It's all documented. Don't worry, I can pick it up real fast.
Wait, somewhere we have a copy of the petition.
That's what I'm saying. It's all on my computer. And one of the,
before we leave, we're going to hand
one, it out. One of the things we need to do is have a plan for how to assemble these materials and then eventually refine them down and make them much more accessible. But I forget her name. But she's a very prominent historian. And she had been part of the women's committee that came up with this. There's a group of about 8 or 10 or 12 women who came up with this award. It wasn't these guys at the university. Although my feeling is that it basically was these guys at the university in the background. But in any case, they came up with this award and they liked the idea. The university since 1972 had been using Cornelia Spencer as an icon to promote women, because, you know, women didn't come to UNC until, 72 or the late 60s or something like that.
Late 60s.
So we got this letter together, and it was framed in such a way that it would not scare people off too much, but it would, in my opinion, lead to an inevitable dissolution of the award, which most people did not believe that was going to happen. Because I basically thought that the facts, the evidence, the way we were presenting it was so powerful and so compelling, and with these kinds of folks to back it up. With the NAACP and the community and stuff, it wasn't like we were saying, well, here's just some big names who agree. Here's some big names who are going to be working with you for the next 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Who you are trying to win over, as the university has been trying to win over support from minority communities and go after more minority students and this and the other. And it's very hard to do that if you have these issues hanging around in a big controversy. And, you know, students from up north are saying, well, yeah, it sounds like a pretty good deal, but I'm not sure I want to go to a school that has a Klansman up front.
Mm-hmm.
And all these southern universities do that, right? I mean, they're trying to scrub their names clean. So, presented this letter, and everybody sort of held their breath for a little while.
Was it published in newspapers, or?
It was published in the Tar Heel, I believe.
Was it?
I'm not sure if the letter itself was or not, but certainly excerpts from it, and a list of people who had signed it, and so on and so forth. And the chancellor wrote me a written response, saying he was willing to talk about this, and blah, blah, blah. And that sort of got things off to a roll. And what we did was we framed it as not calling for abolishing the award. We said, let's hold off on the presentation of this award because we really don't understand this issue. Let's have a university-wide discussion about Cornelia Spencer and white supremacy in the 19th century and the role of the university. And all of this, and then let's decide where to go from here.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that this offends a lot of people right now, before we've even had that big community-wide discussion, shows that there's a tremendous gap between the understanding of many people at the university about this issue. So that's what we proposed, and that was much more
institutional.
You know, how could you really disagree with that? And what they did do, they disagreed with the idea of a moratorium. You know, they disagreed with not doing it. They wanted to go ahead. And Brown and some of these other folks decided that they would not themselves reject and turn down the award. So we were going to have a Bell Award that year, but we worked at it in a fairly non-antagonistic way. Is there stuff that I'm saying that you think is...
No, yeah, the language was... because that was another accusation that we had to respond to, was you can't rewrite history, you know, this just is, and why are you trying to, you know, you can't just abolish the Bell Award and rename the Bell Award. So what the way we responded to that was we said, well, what we're not actually demanding that at this point. What we're saying is that we need to rethink the Bell Award, and you know, that this has to grow out of a democratic conversation.
And did they do that?
They did.
Yeah. And what they did was, we had some negotiations, I forget, but basically what they did was the chancellor took it and put it in the hands of Harry Watson, who's the director of the
Center for the Study of the American
Center for the Study of the American
Southern
South.
Historian. And
right, very prominent kind of person. Newspaper people go to all the time, and said the chancellor sort of laid out some standards for what he wanted to see happen, and it had to do with having an academic panel or an academic day of present workshop day kind of thing, to have scholars present papers that really got at the issues of what was the role of the university in relationship to white supremacy in the 19th century, and you know, what was this all about?
Right. With some sessions focused particularly on Cornelia.
Right.
And
did that take place in classrooms? What were the venues for this conversation?
Where it actually took place?
Yeah, I mean, it was a 2-day event actually. The chancellor provided $10,000 for it.
A big conference with Thomas Holt.
Yeah, we had famous historians there.
Yeah, they brought in people from outside and
students.
You know, the whole campus community was a part of this conversation. And Danny, I don't know how you feel about this, but it's likely. It's quite possible that the chancellor had made the decision, the administration had made a decision that they wanted to do something about the Bell Award, that it could no longer, they realized that it was not sustainable to continue, you know, awarding this in the same fashion, but they needed a cover. They couldn't just do that or there'd be blowback. So the conference provided, it was his way of spending $10,000 to give him some kind of an intellectual cover, and also to see that consensus was built around the decision.
Major things happen.
But I mean, it validated.
Yeah.
That sounds like a wonderful.
Yeah, no, that's exactly the kind of thing that we've been pushing for, was to have an open conversation about this.
Was that conference sort of continued as we were talking earlier of orientation? I mean,
it was continued, but you'll never see its continuation credit. I mean, it doesn't get it, you know, how it came about. Mm-hmm. But out of that conference grew the university's digital history, which I don't know if have you looked at that at all. Mm-hmm. But there's you can go to the UNC website, and they've put a lot of resources in it. I haven't looked at it in a year or so. But they put a lot of resources into documenting, for instance, the civil rights movement at UNC, women's presence at UNC, and then you can find out quite a bit of information about university history through this digital site that was facilitated by Harry Watson and people he's been working with. And that was a that was an outgrowth of the conference. But on that website, you'll never see any sort of recognition that this came about because of this, you know, really protracted struggle over, mm-hmm. you know, these mm-hmm. ideas.
Mm-hmm. You should take that model and bring it into the Chapel Hill Carver School District.
Yeah, yeah, there's ways to do that.
Develop a whole
The thing that's sort of hard to grasp, and that's why we really need a good documented history of this, is that at every stage of the movement, at every stage of the struggle that we were trying to promote, the university was trying to take back, and they were trying to limit it, and they were trying to make it less democratic. So that when this panel was proposed, it was originally four scholars. And they actually did include me, because it was sort of hard to leave me out. And so there was going to be three or four national and UNC scholars who made presentations. And then supposedly the theory goes that this was a two-stage conversation, a campus-wide conversation. So first the professors and them would educate us about what to think. And then there would be a more wide open discussion that just washed itself out into the sea, in my opinion. And so we looked at that and we said, no, this is not going to fly. It's like the university, you know, with the house and the granite plaques, you know. This is not going to fly. You know, where's the voice of African Americans? No voice of African Americans, except maybe some famous African American professor.
You mean the city and the granite plaques? Or the, what granite plaques?
The we're talking about the Peace and Justice Plaza.
Oh, okay. But that's a city initiative, right? Or town initiative, that's not a... What did the university have to do?
It's a town initiative.
Yeah.
But the... You know, the framework doesn't change things that much. It's like...
Well, who's on the panel for this conference drawing parallel to the town and the plaque? Who was...
Oh, no, the plaques, that issue hadn't erupted.
No, I understand that. I'm just going back to the conference. Who was on the panel? And I see this... I see what Yanni's saying. It's the same institutional...
Oh, yeah.
If we had been passive and left it alone, what would have happened would have been this panel of professors. And they were good professors.
In the conference we're talking about, yes.
In the conference for all of us, us to come
to. Mostly white professors.
And be included.
Yes.
And we said, no, this is not going to fly. We need to be part of the conference. We are the ones who are building this movement. And the whole problem to begin with is that these decisions about whatever it is that the university does are not made in any kind of democratic way. And so we said, fine, let's have some academics. Let's have black students and faculty. Let's have black community organizations like the NAACP. Let's have women's organizations. Let's have, we had a whole breakdown, and I wrote the chancellor a letter and said, you know, this isn't going to work. We need to have a much more democratic process here. And then I actually just wrote out a list of people that we wanted on the panel. So these are the people we want here.
And how many did they accept?
Most of them.
That's
right. So instead of four academics, it became about.
Well, it was broken up. You know, there was a few other major speakers sort of added, like Joseph Jordan of the Black Cultural Center, and. Who else? But then we had these sub-panels, sort of like workshop things. and that was where there were presentations, smaller presentations, with someone who presented and someone who questioned. And so that would be like, say, the head of the BSM, and someone who was questioning would be General Lourdes of the university faculty. And we had about four of those, I think.
There were some kind of cards where people would write questions or
feedback
or suggestions.
Yeah, and went all the way down to having individual participation, where we ended up in the afternoon with workshops. They provided lunch, and during lunch we had these workshops outside around, what was that building? That Person Hall?
Which one?
Was it Person Hall? It's down there. It's in the center of campus. And it was built by slaves. So, and groups of, say, 15 people would meet. And this was after the academic presentations and so on and so forth. And this was where people, listeners from the university, basically, would take notes about what people said should be done and try to come up with certain kinds of programs to make that happen. And so this university museum, virtual museum, because it was going to be online as opposed to an actual building.
This is the digital archive that you're talking about?
Yeah,
that came out of the conference.
Directly.
And this idea, actually, in my opinion, was decided on long before the conference. Most people probably don't have any opinion on that. But that guy from the trustee.
Do you think that was in the works, a digital museum?
Yeah, because I picked up on some conversations before that ever took place. And I was with this man, John Sanford, guy who was on the trustees, who was like a big brain for the university in terms of how to deal with these kinds of things.
I'd love to see this done for the town, you know, or the county. You know, we've been playing with this Justice in Action Committee, which really has such promise, but it's just not grounded because it doesn't have the people on it. But it could really be the voice of moving the council to have this same important conversation. They're planning something like, I call it healing the racial divide, but it isn't quite that. It's people coming and telling stories of how they've helped bridge the racial divide or something like that. You know, it sounds very nice, except it's three very nice white people who are organizing it. And I'm meeting with Andre Wesson. I wish I could propose, it may be too late, but it just seems that's a logical, forget this immediate thing they're doing because there's not enough time to change it, but it seems to me that after the FLACS, Peace and Justice Plaza, there ought to be something now more substantial coming out of that. And that's part of the reason, you know, we're here. What's coming out of the 47 marker? How do we institutionalize those important events and bring them into larger conversations and into the schools? And I'm thinking, just as a sidebar, the essays. And that's why I asked you if you kept track of these actors, these important leaders and activists.
All the papers were published from the conference.
I'm thinking Yanni wanted to, we instituted an essay contest for the marker, right? To keep that going on every occasion that students in school adopt an important historic figure. Study it, make a presentation in the school or community or church, and then, you know, start telling these stories as we plan the more formal organization and continuation of the history.
Yeah. These kinds of things are very dynamic and get lots of publicity and involvement.
And teams, not just individual students, but teams. Teams of students.
But from the point of view of moving ahead our committee, the thing that enabled this to happen was that we developed a core of people who met regularly and put tremendous energy into studying these issues, critiquing what the stuff would be. I mean, we'd have to move. You know, you'd have to respond to your stuff. And so we would do that. And luckily we had enough good evidence and sharp people who could participate in that process to have a solid core that was able to actually act as a small steering committee for this whole general notion of accuracy and truth in history, you know, in commemoration. And you know, in large measure, that's what motivated the highway markers. I mean, it had a few different roots and different origins, but that's how we knew how to do that. At least that's for me how I thought I knew how to do it. Anyway, as you can see, within the space of 3 years, you know, the two of you coming here within the 3 years, and you not getting involved until 3 years ago or whatever, that this fairly significant history has been pretty much lost. You know, just that it all happened. It didn't all happen outside the university, but. And it's hard. You can say, okay, Rob Stevens or whoever, this is an important struggle that you all should know about. And he'll say, how do I do that? And then you have to, I have to go through this whole thing. Mm-hmm. Or we have to dig up some documents or something. It's not all collected and made accessible. Some student who wants to do a paper for a professor cannot just hop into the library and say, I need the resources on the Bell Award struggle. There are such things, in part, you know, newspaper clippings and things like that. But it's not all gathered together. And that's why I did that scrapbook about
What scrapbook?
The scrapbook about the sweatshop. And that told the whole story of the development of this movement. Sweatshop.
Whoops.
Which,
how is this sweatshop movement? Is this the housekeepers meeting?
No, this is the students at angle of the housekeepers thing, uh-huh. In the sense that it was the upsurge of students all across the country who got involved in the whole idea of fighting sweatshops as a way of targeting their universities,
uh-huh. Yes.
Aside from how they treated the housekeepers.
Right.
Although it was initially connected with that.
Yeah. Did they stop UNC from purchasing all their shirts and stuff were made? I switch out labor. That was about 10.
As I understand it, what the United Students for Against Sweatshops have asked universities to conform to these particular codes.
Right.
But I think every time, it seems like they succeed in getting a number of universities to mm-hmm. accept the, you know, to do that and to purchase only from sweatshops that honor these codes, but over time, I think there have been two successive sets of codes that the students now deem ineffective, and so they're continually asking them to subscribe to these stricter guidelines, and that's kind of, and I think that's where, I think where Mieser left off is he rejected the students' demand that they accept this new set of guidelines, and he kind of you know, held on to. He said we're already part of, you know, a consortium that we feel comfortable with.
I have to leave in about 10 or 15 minutes. So okay. I'm kind of anxious to begin to formalize this in order to put some form around this. The first thing that concerns and excites me is the stories. We've had storytelling. We need how to share that storytelling, and how, as you said, the study groups. And my biggest concern, most immediate concern, is retrieving the documents and then putting them in a user-friendly way that we can begin. While we talk about organizational form within NAA, how we put the material in easily readable and accessible.
I'm trying to
find. And it's a work in progress. I mean, it doesn't have to be perfect.
I'm trying to find our website.
I just want to. I hope if this takes us in a direction we don't want to go in, then just ignore it. But you might have seen where the state of Mississippi has just adopted a requirement that all, you know, I don't know what level of students, but
K through 12,
they have to be, excuse me. The civil rights movement is going to be integrated into the curriculum, and it's going to be mandatory.
Has South Carolina done the same thing?
South Carolina? God, no.
Okay, because someone else thought that they had, and I knew that Mississippi just did it for this, starting this school
right.
year, and it's for K through 12.
Yeah, but it, I don't know, it strikes me as a real promising possibility.
Absolutely.
For,
we should find out
not necessarily
how
at the state level, I mean, I think that will come, but as a demand for Chapel Hill Carbara,
they'd be
really susceptible.
Yeah, get the material, you know, start getting things together, and then say, shouldn't this be everywhere?
Yeah.
Why do I know about naval stores? I mean, you know, like if you're tar and resin in the Revolutionary War. And,
how could we access that curriculum quickly? It must be on.
Well, that's what I was, that was a question I was going to, I mean, I think it is accessible, but I might know some people who have access to it, but that would be a good starting point, is
this
to get a
statewide.
Hold of
this
statewide in Mississippi.
If you study North Carolina history, 4th grade and 8th grade, the whole year, twice. I couldn't believe it when my daughter got to middle school. It's like, but that's good. I mean, we just need to get Wilmington in 1898 in there.
Right,
And all the, I mean, there's so much here.
Aside from 1898 missing and some probably other games?
No, I mean, it's the usual self-serving. Well, what Whitehead did, and how hard it was for them to do it. I'm sure there are a few things, but it's not the problems with institutional racism.
That would be a good thing to work around and build in fellowship with our own.
I mean, so much here. I mean, the lunch counter sit-ins down
much
the road.
In this house.
In 1947,
this house. That's it.
See, this is where I fall down. I have such a hard time concentrating.
What are you trying to access?
Well, let's see if you can do it, or maybe it's Dependa. You were here when I did this before, or you were. The a little blog, the blog site. It's under blog site.
Your own, like, family blog?
Now the Freedom... No, the Truth to Power project. Mm-hmm. We have a website.
I think you emailed.
Kevin was able to go into my email, the one that you sent for this, and he started getting into it.
Let me see if
he can access his entire research file, which is on his computer.
No, but that might come out of this.
What?
Not yet.
Okay.
But that could come out of this.
We've got to start on that.
Good.
So, let's see. What's the best way to find out? There should be an easy way to do it, but my mind is so fucked up. Let's see.
Can you tell me what you're looking for and I can try to find it?
Yeah.
I think he has something under
documents. It is a...
So this would be in a... I should do like a Google search?
It's one of the... You know the services that Google provides? One of them is called Google Sites. And if you find Google Sites, then it'll have go to your account. And you go there and you'll see Truth to Freedom and Truth to Power site.
Is that the same as all your files you told me about yesterday that you've collected over the years and all your research?
Right.
Just
so why don't you pass that around?
Then there's another site.
And it's got there's a few other things written on it, which you can visit. It wouldn't take long. I mean, in other words, there's a few follow-up.
Didn't you tell me there was a file, I'll have to look at my notes, a legacy file? No, there is a legacy file. And you said there was, I don't know if that's the right title. And that has all your research, your dissertation, your just a
whole bunch
of files.
Well, it's got some stuff. None of it is
something. But that's not the same as the truth.
No, that's just something for our Truth to Power project.
I'm saying that part of that project is another file that has to be retrieved and stored. Yanni's, and he's just have challenged by himself doing it, so someone else has to do it, and that is all the history that he's been story that he's been telling us today, and that's on that. Am I right? And I thought
that's
you said
computer,
it was
yeah.
called Legacy
Important something. Legacy Projects,
and under that are all the files, the various research, no?
Some of
papers,
some of them. Some of the important ones, like the dissertation, the thesis, you know, a variety
right.
of other things. And so I think a decision that we could make probably right now is, do we want to use this freedom, like this Truth to Power website for us to be able to access all of those documents? And if we do, how do we do that? Do we just put them in a file on my computer and then make a link? We make a link with each one?
I don't know much about... This might be something where Kevin is very computer savvy.
So you guys, you are not the ones.
I'm not. He is.
And he's really, that's his professional
We're the visionaries.
Yes, speak
I think anybody.
So we're the visionaries and implementers.
This is something that anybody could go to. Are you talking about this?
This is not something necessarily that anybody could go to.
But it's where we would gather.
They would have to know that this site existed. And it's a public site at this point, but you know, it can be made private at several different levels. It can just be us.
But I see this as
the
library from which we draw important historic context for our work.
We might even call this section of it the library.
And then start putting that, assembling that.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that sounds good.
Okay, so we get Kevin over here to work on this.
And tell him
exactly what
you're
going to make this accessible.
The only thing I'm a little concerned about with Kevin is that he's a PC person.
Oh,
what is this? Is this
are the rest of you Mac people?
Oh, gosh.
How
interesting.
Well, you'll find
But the only thing I'm worrying there, I think he's perfectly capable of dealing with Mac stuff.
Yeah, if he's doing it on here, it'll be...
And as long as it doesn't involve using a bunch of new software that some of us can't.
Okay.
I don't think it will. He starts there.
We have Google stuff. And that can be used for almost anything.
The other help me out here. The other challenge, first accessing the material, is then somebody's looking at the material, and I'm now thinking of a, you know, an all-day NAA seminar or even small study groups, is to make them into a curriculum that's user-friendly.
That is a big leap, in my opinion.
Well, it's going to have to be done at some point. If we're going
to
turn...
Yeah, but just to take all these documents and make a curriculum, I think we need to think about
The first... I go fast. The first step is access and getting the documents.
Which means collecting them a place that...
That's right. I'm assuming that's already going to be done. I just want to start.
Well, it hasn't been done, and that's going to take
kind of happening, right?
That's going to happen.
What?
It's happening, right? Like
we are making it happen right now.
Right now.
So, Gene is doing some things.
That's the first thing. If we can set it up so that we have this place that people can go to access stuff,
right?
And then we can add to it, you know, little by little.
Mm-hmm.
And have some of the most important things on there to begin with, like the dissertation, let's say. Then that provides us with a developmental working kind of tool. But if we don't get that thing set up in a way that is user-friendly and so forth, it won't make any difference.
I think we can get Kevin over here on Sunday. Sunday is wide open for us. And maybe he can sit with you, Yanni, and he could take that computer right there and start putting that in place.
How do you feel about that? And then we can start adding stuff to it. Like the shells and everything.
The boxes into this.
Sunday's good. Sunday's wide open.
He's got boxes.
Well, we probably can't start with data, but if we start with things that are digitized.
Yeah, right.
I mean, that's there, so somebody could always go to it.
It's
digital,
it's
so.
Also, I haven't seen this.
So we're talking about Sunday the 11th, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
Are schools closed Monday? Sorry. Is that good for you, Yanni?
The 23rd. I think it's Friday.
Now, I know day-to-day what you're feeling. Should I run
that
by
Sunday we're talking about, right?
Yes.
Hmm?
The only thing I got to be careful about is some family obligations.
Okay, is that in the morning or in the afternoon? You get me running by Sandy or June?
No, it's more of Saul and Corn. I would say, man,
how are you, John?
Hello.
I'm doing okay. This is Charles.
Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
I actually need to get it out, and I'm walking by a van.
Oh,
sorry.
I meant to ask when I came in.
Is that a bike rider shirt?
No, it's just a plain t-shirt.
I'm sorry, I got a pattern.
Charles lives upstairs.
I used to live upstairs as well, yeah. My name's Carrie. Did you live there last year as well?
Yes.
Or do you have, okay. Good. So is it the same group that you, because you moved in right after I moved out.
It's...
And do you have mostly the same people that you moved
mostly,
in?
Mostly, yeah.
Okay.
We have one exchange.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, good to
meet you.
Good to meet you. Bye-bye. Seemed like a nice group, huh?
That's a great group.
They're really nice.
Yeah.
They love my dog.
Good, unlike the last tenants.
You guys did great. You came around.
The dogs came around. Those things were unruly when I first met them. Unfit to be with people.
I think they're getting used to it. This is a beautiful pen.
You want it?
Yeah,
but I'll get it back to you.
Is that how we're looking on Sunday,
Johnny? Sunday.
Can we follow up tomorrow with you and Jean?
I think in the evening. We have to be
Sunday evening.
Early evening. Let's say about 6 o'clock.
Okay.
When are you best? Because maybe they have to shift some visitors. This may really take priority.
You're saying you kind of get going in the early evening these days, huh?
I can get that nap in.
I'm saying that 6 o'clock Sunday is the best time for
me. Oh, really?
Sunday.
You're pretty good now. Pretty good.
Huh?
You're pretty good at 11:30.
Yeah, but you see, like, what I'm going to be doing with Arnie and Saul is working in the shop. And that's going to be a big...
You're going to walk out to the shop?
It would be my last trip, I don't know. But it has to do with passing on tools and just a way for us to spend a little time together with the guys.
Yeah. Well, that's important because Saul's son is going to need to know the history of those tools.
That's right.
Do they know the sex of the baby yet? Well, you know what? I mean, I was telling Yanni last night, I'm happy. You know, I come through, you know, periodically, once a month, I'm probably here. But, and I would like to, if our time offers the opportunity, I'd like I've known Yanni now for 8 years, and I'm an oral historian, but we never... You know, because he was always downstairs.
The hospice nurse is here.
Conducted a whole oral history.
You guys don't need to change anything that we're doing. I'll just
Someone could be in touch with me and just sort of keep me in the loop, and I can plug in. I mean, the other thing is I have lots of some of the same documents and things that might be useful. So I'm Kerry.
Okay, I won't be here because I'm a Luddite.
Taylor.
I will be at Novus.
Okay.
At Sunday.
Citadel.edu. I don't have a card with me or anything, but do you have anything? Or?
I don't have
so
anything.
If you just shoot me an email, and then I'll have...
What did she say?
Yeah. That would be great. And I would like to just, you know, hear... The other thing is...
Is this the same...
You know, there's the people that I'm working with in Charleston who, you know, are thinking through a lot of the same kinds of issues.
Okay.
That I've been working with.
Let me say, I'm not 100% sure.
Some people who are plugged into the Charleston NAACP who are watching what's happening in North Carolina with Reverend Barber. Very,
my understanding is that people from that group are meeting with the county.
We're really excited by what's happening.
The county manager to address their case.
You know, we can.
That
maybe help broaden the conversation to a
that
Carolina wide.
Yeah, the water people
are coming to the chapel. Right.
I would assume that their feeling is just because it got taken off that list doesn't mean that they're not in the process. And I mean, I think that's how anybody, you know, remember us, don't pop the champagne. So those folks, I think, are continuing and unilaterally. To press their case and meet with the county and show the mill house
that's
renovated and so forth, which to me pushes things further toward
straightforward kind of
here.
And then from there, when you talk about what's the next step, if they're not,
you know, if they're not saying,
what about the other part of mill house that the county owns?
That's us.
We've been running since 7 this morning. Fortune
hasn't
eaten all day.
Oh no.
We could have
run to the corner.
I promise you Chick-fil-A. Bad stuff.
And so if Chapel of Us is in the house one off, then that makes us more valuable. Vulnerable. Plus the county owns it.
And we'll come, and whether you're sleeping or whatever you're doing, you know, I think if we can put this in Kevin's hand and just get him started, we can pull it together, okay?
I have no idea what that means.
Yeah. Carrie, nice to meet you.
It's really nice to meet you. Yeah. Be in touch. You can go around, or it's probably easiest
it's
just to
cut
across
out.
The porch.
Okay. Ladies? Yes, we're going.
Just watch for poo on the
walk. Are we going to do my stay? Hi, Dad.
We'll see. Oh, something for you.
I can talk to
you on the way out.
Okay.
All right,
I got it, Nancy.
So I'm saying we have to have an attorney against it.
Yeah. Bye-bye. Miriam, nice to meet you.
Please stay in touch.
Likewise.
Pound cake. This may not be for you. Can you eat some pound cake?
Oh, yeah.
So, for you, if not for somebody you love.
You're the one.
Pardon?
You know that Nancy writes cookbooks.
You mentioned that last night. What sort of stuff?
Well, I specialize in Asian food, from being the Peace Corps in Thailand. I started writing about that.
I also cook.
And so I've done mostly Asian and curries and so forth. But when we moved here 10 years ago, and after I was here a couple of years, I remembered Southern baking, so I've done a cake book. And I have a pie, Southern cakes, and then I'm working with Southern pies is going to come out sometime next year. So, but this is not my cake. This is Miss Louise from the Louise Parrish from the farmers market.
Nice.
Old school pancake.
A little bit of butter in there.
She a Merritt Mill Road Parish?
No, she's a Parish Road Parish. She's out near.
Hey.
Hello.
How are you guys today?
Good.
I'm Robin.
Hi, Robin.
Hey, Robin.
Hey, Emmy. Nice to see you today. How are you feeling? You've got a crowd here.
I'm feeling pretty good, actually.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
Before we start, could I just get one thing clear with Karen?
Absolutely.
How do I find that site again? Or did you bookmark it?
Let me bookmark it. I mean, I just went, well, I did what you told me.
You want to write it on your pad also? Or is that, also in the shop? I write things down, then I don't look at that place I wrote it down.
It's a problem, I know.
My hand works, but not if I do good hand washing, and I do.
Got to get a Sharpie.
Get a couple of days out of that.
Yeah, if you go to your bookmarks, and then it's the last one down there at the bottom. Think you can handle that?
What does it say?
It'll say NAACP History Committee.
Okay.
That should do it. So you're doing physical therapy?
No, that's not me. I am a hospice nurse.
Okay.
And actually, a woman by the name of Diane is Yanni's regular nurse, but I am kind of here just helping her out today. She's on the other side of town, Yanni, so she sent me down with your Clorox big box out there that Jean's got. So you should be all set with that. Your oxygen.
Six bottles?
There's a whole bunch of them in there. Maybe even more than that. And I wanted to double check and make sure that Triangle Aftercare had been up. Looks like they have, and Jean told me they fixed. Figured out the problem